Once upon a time, once upon a time, or perhaps we should say, once out of time, since the text in which these conversations are recorded are said to be, are seen by tradition to be sort of beyond time and eternal, there were some sages, and they discussed the nature of this world, and the nature of the absolute, and the nature of God, and the nature of the self. And they came up with all sorts of statements saying that everything is Brahman. They were saying that you, each one of us, we are Brahman. We are the self, the universal self. He had statements along the lines of that the self, in this sense, of God, is beyond our perception. He's beyond our the range of our senses. We cannot, in Yajnavalkya's words, we cannot perceive the perceiver who does the perceiving. We cannot hear the hearer who does the hearing, and so on. So you have all these sages that come up with these various statements about the about God, about the world, about the self, and they, they're collected in a corpus of text known as the Upanishads, which I'm sure you all know, and the nature of these statements is of various kinds. Some statements stress the unity of everything. Some statements stress the difference of between God and the world and God and the self and so on. And if we then move a couple of centuries later to the 8th, 9th century in South India, there was a very young man, much younger than most of us, who started contemplating on these teachings and came up with a way of reconciling these different statements, saying that when the Upanishads talk about the unity of God and the world and the self, that is actually the highest teaching. That's actually the real teaching. And when they talk about the difference between the world and God and between God and the self, that's sort of a lower teaching. So he came up with this sort of two-level way of looking at things. And of course, you all know his name. That was Shankaracharya. And then if you move again a few centuries later, you get another thinker of a very different kind, Ramanuja. And Keith Ward has given a very erudite introduction or overview of his thought in the last lecture. And he had a very different way of reconciling these contradictory statements. And he would not say that there's sort of two levels of reality, but rather that when it talks about the unity of God in the world, we have to understand it as sort of the analogy he uses is of God and the body, of the soul and the body, and that the body is fully dependent on its existence of the soul, and is sort of controlled by the soul and so on. And if we then move again a little later, we get to a very different thinker, and that is a very staunch and sort of strong, physically strong person, and intellectually also very bold in many of his statements. And he would say, no, these differences are essential, and we cannot ignore them. And these differences, everything has sort of the inherent characteristics of everything is different. And you have God, and you have the self, and you have the world, and they're very different things, and they're not equal in any sense. And the reason I sort of want to give you that brief overview of Vedantic thought is because often it's presented as that you have Shankara, and he comes and says everything is one, and then you have Madhva, who says no, everything is two. And you sort of have Ramanuja, who kind of comes in the middle and says everything is one and two, sort of in sort of his complex way of analyzing it. And it's often said that so some people are surprised by that sort of you have that the order of the thinkers is first Shankara, then Ramanuja, and then Madhva, where you sort of some people would expect, okay, first you have Shankara, sort of one extreme. Then you have Madhva, the other extreme, and then you have Ramanuja, who kind of attempts to strike a middle balance, a middle ground. And of course, one may wonder, why should the history of intellectual ideas, you know, sort of progress in that way? But what I want to argue today, actually, is that if we want to look for a synthesis of both these statements, we actually don't have to look at Ramanuja per se, but Jiva Goswami would fit that much better, and I'll show you why. And Jiva Goswami sort of strikes a balance between Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva, and sort of attempts to bring all of them together. So who was Jiva Goswami? I don't know if, I assume at least most of you have at least heard of him. Jiva Goswami is, of course, a 16th century author, and he's from Bengal, but spent most of his intellectual life in Vrindavan in the north central India. And he's a very interesting thinker, and a very different one in some senses from Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva, whereas those three thinkers are pure Vedantists, and they deal with the statements of the Upanishads as they are presented and studied in the Brahma Sutra. Jiva Goswami does not directly engage with the Brahma Sutra, but does that through the Bhagavata Purana, and says this is this text gives the same teachings as the Brahma Sutra. And as Ravi Gupta has shown, he does have a lot of Vedantic elements in his thought, but he does that through the study of the Bhagavata. So we get sort of a different source coming in into the discussion here, which leads to a lot of interesting sort of things that happen. Now, Jiva Goswami was a very prolific author and a very difficult author, I have to say. And just to give you an idea of his works, I just have a few of them here. He wrote different types of works. You have these two are his main works. These are actually six works combined into volumes, and they're the Sandarbhas. They're basically, this is Jiva Goswami's systematic overview of his theology. He goes from the beginning, from epistemology, and goes all the way to, you know, through the nature of God to the way of one attains salvation and so on. He goes into all these topics here. So he goes the Tattva Sandarbha, which is about the nature of truth, the Bhagavat Sandarbha, which is about the nature of God, the Paramatma Sandarbha, which is about the nature of God, but specifically in his relation with the world. Yeah, the Krishna Sandarbha, which is specifically about the nature of Krishna. And then in this volume, you have the Bhakti Sandarbha, about the path of devotion, and the Preeti Sandarbha, about the perfection of devotion. Now, Jiva Goswami is a very difficult writer. His language is not easy. Fortunately, these works have, apart from the Tattva Sandarbha, have not been translated. So they're a bit inaccessible. He also wrote other things like these two thick volumes. And this is the Gopal Champu, which is his sort of, it's poetry, basically, about the life of Krishna. And he wrote quite some poetry as well, so that's sort of a very different area of his writing. And he wrote an interesting work, the Harinamamrita Vyakarana, which is a work on grammar, in which he teaches Sanskrit grammar, and at the same time sort of does some theology as well. He kind of weaves the two together, and some Sanskrit rules, he sort of, the way he explains them at the same time, you know, by saying, okay, you have to apply this and this rule here, at the same time he's teaching theology. And his ideas, of course, for his disciples and so on, that they can study Sanskrit, but at the same time sort of do some religious activities as well. And then you have another category of his texts, and those are commentaries. Jiva Goswami wrote a lot of commentaries, but he wrote commentaries on very different texts than the other Vedantic teachers would do. He wrote commentaries on the Bhagavata Purana. In fact, he wrote two. He wrote commentaries on this little text, the Brahma Samhita. which is a text that's very important for Jiva Goswami's tradition, but nobody else really cares about. He wrote a commentary on another on one of the Upanishads that's sort of generally not one of the Upanishads that's used in Vedantic circles. That's the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. And then he wrote commentaries on the works of his uncle, Rupa Goswami. And this is the Ujjala Nilamani, and this is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And he wrote lengthy commentaries on them, very learned commentaries. And these texts are about the nature of bhakti, about devotion. So these are the sources I'll be drawing. I'll be mainly drawing from his commentaries on the works of Rupa Goswami and on these sandarbhas. Now, okay. The big problem that Vedantic teachers have is, I suppose we could very simplify it and say there's two big problems they have. Is one is about the nature of God and what but one is about the nature of God, and the other is about the relationship between God and the world. And of course, you have in the Upanishads, you have all these statements that talk about the indivisible nature of God, that God is one, that he's one without a second, that he's Advaita, he's non-dual, there's no duality in God, and so on. So that's one big area where Jiva Goswami and the other authors will have a lot to say about. And the other one is God's relationship with the world. If you have a God that is non-dual, that is sort of has no divisions in it, and if he is one without a second, that there's only one exists, how do you deal with the world? And Shankara, of course, has a very interesting way of approaching this, basically by saying, let's get rid of the world, and then we solve the problem. Of course, it's a bit more complex than that, but basically by saying the world is illusion, therefore let me backtrack. The reason why the relationship with the world is such an issue is because it touches on the first point about the indivisible nature of God, about the unity of God, because you have the world there. And if the world is somehow part of God's existence, there's change in the world, there's dualities in the world. And the world is in Indian philosophy, is generally seen as something that's not perfect. So you have these things there, so does that mean that there's imperfection in God? Does that mean there's change in God? And that would sort of deny the first principle. So you have to find a way of dealing with that. And Shankara would say, okay, the world is false, that's a sort of illusion. It doesn't really exist, but he kind of comes up with this thing that you can't say it does exist and you can't say it does not exist, so therefore it's anirvachaniya, you cannot, it's indescribable. And that's sort of his way of dealing with it. And, you know, Keith Ward in the last talk, you know, showed how Ramanuja dealt with it. Now, how does Jiva Goswami deal with this? And he deals with this with by talking about God's power, by God's energy or God's potency, and that is the term Shakti. So you have Shakti, and this is really the very essence of Jiva Goswami's thought. Everything else turns around this thing, this concept of Shakti. Shakti, of course, you know, comes from Sanskrit, which Shak, it means it's energy, but it's kind of a potentiality, a potency that's there. And there's one analogy that Jiva Goswami uses again and again and again and again and again, and that's he gets that from the Vishnu Purana, and I gave you that verse there on the handout. And it's an analogy that's very important for him. And the text goes, just as fire is situated in one place, but its light spreads, so the energy, Shakti, of the Supreme Brahman spreads throughout the universe. So the analogy is that, of course, is of fire. You have, say, you have a fire, and there's light that comes from it. And Jiva Goswami says this is the way God relates to his Shakti. And there's quite some parallels here with Ramanuja, but he uses it in very different ways. So you have fire, and you have the light that comes from the fire. Jiva Goswami uses this thing to say that The Shaktis are natural to God. This is his first point. That just as whenever you light a fire, you have light. And light is a quality, sort of an attribute of fire, but it comes naturally. It's not that sometimes you light a fire and there's no light, you know, it's a dark fire or there's no heat or something like that. It comes naturally. It's therefore it's innate to fire. You cannot have fire without heat or without light. Whenever you have fire, you have light. So in the same way, whenever you have God, you will have His Shakti there. You cannot separate them. You cannot say, okay, here we have just God's Shakti, here we have God's energy, and God is not there. No, whenever there is the Shakti, there is God, and whenever there is the God, there is the Shakti, they're sort of inseparable. But also Jiva Goswami uses it to say that it's natural in the sense that it doesn't require any effort. Fire does not have to do anything special for it to produce light. So God does not have to do anything special to produce his energy, to sort of exhibit his potency. It comes naturally from him without any effort. And another aspect of this analogy that's very important to Jiva Goswami is that the emission of light from fire does not sort of change fire. It does not diminish fire in any sense. So it's not that when God exhibits that God's potency, that God's energies in some ways limit God or sort of make him weaker or anything like that. It's not like when we do some activity that we get tired and exhausted and we go, oh, now I have to rest. God doesn't have to do that. It comes naturally. It doesn't change him in any way. It's very similar to Ramanuja's idea of the soul and the body, that he also has this point that whenever you have the soul, sort of the conception of the body is included in the conception of the soul. The idea of God, of the world and the self is included in the idea of God. So in the same way here, the idea of God's energy is included in God, and you cannot separate them. Now Jiva Goswami comes up with three different types of energies that are there of God. One is the Bahiranga Shakti, the external energy. One is the Antaranga Shakti, the internal energy, which he also calls the Swarupa Shakti, the Shakti, the energy of God's own form. And then you have the Tatastha Shakti, the sort of the marginal, the one that's on the edge, that's one, the one that's on the potency that's on the border. Now, the Bahiranga Shakti, the external energy, and that's the world. That's the world as in which we live. The internal energy, the Antaranga Shakti or the Swarup Shakti, that's God's own internal energy. That's the energy that manifests, as we'll see later, His various attributes and so on, and the Tatastha Shakti, the marginal energy. Literally, Tatastha is of course Ta, staying on the Tata, on the bank. In Indian thought, they always say that the bank is not the river, but it's also not land. It's also not just general land. It's sort of in between, and sometimes it's covered by the river. Sometimes when the river, the level of the river rises, then the bank is flooded. But sometimes it's land. So sometimes it's water. Sometimes it's land. So that's the Tatastha Shakti, and that's us basically. That's the living entities. They're the marginal potency. They can be either controlled by the Bahiranga Shakti, by the external energy, as we are. We are in this world, so we're influenced by this, or they can be for those that are liberated, they're with God Himself, so they're within his own internal energy, sort of the energy of his own being. The Bahiranga Shakti, the external energy, that is God's, that is the world. So one can say, well, this is a big problem for Jiva Goswami. Because as I've mentioned earlier, that the world is changing, the world is imperfect, the world is in transformation at all times. So if this is one of the shaktis, if this is one of the energies of God, and as I mentioned, God's energies are intrinsic to him and are sort of inseparable from him, doesn't that not mean that these energies are that basically sort of God has within him imperfection and change? And Jiva Goswami would say, no, this is not the case. And this is where a very crucial aspect of his thought comes in, and that is his sort of idea of bheda bheda. He says it's different and it's non-different at the same time. So he would say that you have the light of the fire, and he would say that is intrinsic to fire. It is non-different from fire. You cannot separate the two. And yet at the same time he will say, yet they're different, because I can talk about the heat or about the light of the fire and not refer to the fire itself. So they're sort of separate things as well. But also I can hide a fire behind those shelves there, and I can see the effect of the fire. I can see the light, the room is illuminated, but I do not see the fire. So they're separate as well. So it's abheda, a difference, and abheda, and non-difference at the same time. How does this work? How can something be sort of different and non-different at the same time? And that's sort of Jiva Goswami's big thing. It's achintya. It's inconceivable. You cannot comprehend it. And that's just the way it is. And you cannot comprehend it. It's achintya. You can describe it and all that, but exactly how it works, that is achintya. The analogy Jiva Goswami uses here to explain the relationship of the world to God is, I gave you another passage there, under two Maya. This is from the Bhagavad Sandarbha. He uses the analogy of the sun. And we'll see this analogy is used. This is another important analogy of Jiva Goswami. And he uses this in various ways. But here he uses it to describe the relationship between God and the world. And he says, actually, the passage might seem strange, but what he's doing there, it's a very sort of traditional way of writing. He's commenting really on a verse from the Bhagavata, where God himself is speaking. So that's why what they do is they kind of paraphrase, they sort of pull out some things that are implicitly mentioned in the verse. So that's why it's in the first person here. So it's God speaking himself. So it says, that is Maya, which does not appear where I, God, am, but appears where I am not. In other words, which appears out of me, but not without me, like the reflection of the sun, which appears in the pond on the earth, away from the sun, but not without the sun, which is its cause. Just as a reflection of the sun does not touch the sun, even though it cannot exist without it, Maya does not touch Bhagavan, does not touch God, even though it cannot exist without him. And this is a very important point for Jiva Goswami, that the reflection in a sort of a body of water of the sun, this is like the world. It is fully dependent on the existence of the sun, which is God. But at the same time, it is different from it. It is separated from it. And that's why it's Bahiranga. It's the external energy. It's that which is separated from God. So there's sort of a removal from God. The world is removed from God. But yet it is fully dependent on God. If you take the sun away, there won't be a reflection of the sun. They cannot exist without each other. but in the same way, the reflection of the sun in the water, you know, whatever imperfections there may be, if you take a sort of a big pot of water or sort of a big container of water, and the sun is reflected in that, and you shake the container, there's ripples in the water, and the sun is kind of distorted. So there's distortion, if you want, in this world. There's imperfection in this world. But that distortion that you see in the reflection of the sun and the water does not reflect back on the sun. It's not because that the water is troubled, that therefore the sun is somehow imperfect. So in the same way, the world may be imperfect, but that does not reflect back on God. That's his way of looking at it. now... The the concept of Shakti, the concept of energy, is very, very crucial for Jiva Goswami, not just of dealing with the world, but also really of understanding the nature of God himself. And I have to introduce something else now, another aspect of his way of looking at things. And you have that there on the third point, the three aspects of God. And this is a verse from the Bhagavata that's very, very, very crucial to Jiva Goswami, and that he quotes again and again and again, that he comments on again and again and again. And this is sort of one of the most important things he teaches, and one of the most unique, actually. This is a verse, and you'll see it seems like a relatively straightforward verse. Knowers of reality, of tattva, declare that reality to be non-dual consciousness, called Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And this is a verse that, you know, it's in the Bhagavata, and all sorts of Vedantic thinkers have commented on the Bhagavata, and they all, for none of them, it's really a big thing in the way that it is for Jiva Goswami. They just say, yes, you have this reality, which is non-dual, and you know, sometimes it's called Brahman, sometimes it's called Paramatma, and sometimes it's called Bhagavan. Big deal. That's the end of it. You know, it's just different names for the same thing. For Jiva Goswami, this is not the way he looks at it, and he says that no. These are three names that refer to the same thing, but they're also three individual aspects of God, they're not just sort of arbitrary names. And it's very specific. There's a reason why these three names are given, and not say Purushottama or something else. So you have Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. There are three aspects of God's nature, three ways in which God manifests Himself or can be perceived. This is actually quite revolutionary, in a sense, and it's something that we don't see in Shankara or in Ramanuja or in Madhva. It's something that's very unique to Jiva Goswami, and you have the way you have to look at this is I have to first explain the terms, I suppose. You have Brahman. Brahman is Shankaracharya's Brahman, basically. It is the non-dual, attributeless, sort of impersonal feature of God. It has no qualities, it has no form, it has no name, nothing. You know, it's just sort of as Jiva Goswami says, Kevala Vishesha. It has no distinctions. It has no attributes whatsoever. Then you have Paramatma. Paramatma is the aspect of God that's related to this world. It's the indwelling spirit, if you want. It's God present within the creation, within the heart of every being. And finally, you have Bhagavan, and Bhagavan is God. So for Jiva Goswami, this is the highest form of God, the highest manifestation of God, and he uses those three terms here in a very technical sense. They're not just sort of random names of calling that same thing, but they refer to very specific aspects of God, and we'll get into this. Now, why is this revolutionary? Because if you compare him with Ramanuja, so far we've seen there's quite some similarity with Ramanuja in sort of his way of thinking. sort of there's parallels there, but Ramanuja would not say, and in fact he emphatically argues against the idea of a Brahman, of God who is not qualified. Ramanuja's is Vishishtadvaita. It's a qualified non-dualism, and the Vishishta, the qualified, is very important for him, and he will say everything is Vishishta, everything is qualified. You cannot have something that's not qualified by something. But of course he would say it's Advaita at the same time. It's sort of the qualification, the sort of the attribute is in some sense non-different from that which is attributed. But Jiva Goswami says no, there is something that is Kevala Vishesha, that has no distinction, that has no attributes. So When I mentioned in the beginning that I think Jiva Goswami fits much better the sort of the idea of someone that's trying to, that sort of synthesizes the various schools. You see this here, for example, and he's able to incorporate Shankaracharya's ideas into his own theology and say, yes, there is a place for this. And in fact, in these sandarbhas, Jiva Goswami says that for the if you want to know about Brahman, you can go to the Advaitins. You know, they know this stuff. So that you can ask them about this, and so it's kind of an acknowledgement that okay, there's something there in you. The aspect of Paramatma, of course, that we have in Ramanuja and Madhva, the sense of the Antaryami, the Lord that's present within creation. But for Jiva Goswami, again, this takes on a very a special sort of has a lot of important implications, which I'll mention in just a moment. And then you have Bhagavan, which is God with his full attributes, and that of course you have in Ramanuja, and in Madhva, but they won't have the Brahman, and you have Bhagavan in Shankaracharya, but he will say Bhagavan is sort of it's Saguna Brahman, and once you sort of transcend that, you go to Nirguna Brahman, and Brahman without Brahman without any qualities, so. The way you have to understand Jiva Goswami's sort of progression of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, there's a reason he would say that this verse of the Bhagavata mentions them in this order. That it's not Paramatma, Brahman, and Bhagavan, or Bhagavan, Brahman, Paramatma, or something like that. The reason he says is because they're sort of it's a hierarchy. Brahman is the lowest, then you have Paramatma, then you have Bhagavan, and the way you have to understand this is you have to start from the top. If you start from the bottom, it doesn't make any sense. And in fact, you know, Shankaracharya would start from the bottom. I mean, he would sort of turn it around if you want. And he would say, you have Brahman, that is Nirvishesha Brahman, that has no qualities, no attributes, and no distinctions. And then you add distinctions to that, then you have a sort of a personal deity that can be worshipped in your religious practice and so on. If you do that, you basically say that the attributes of God are something sort of not intrinsic to God. They're something that can be added to it. And Jiva Goswami argues against this throughout the Sandarbhas. And if there's one thing he wants his reader to understand, is that you have to start from the top. You have to say, you have Bhagavan, who is God with his full attributes, with his full sort of qualities, and then Paramatma and Bhagavan are the same. Paramatma and Brahman are the same as Bhagavan, are the same as the fullest manifestation of God, except that God is not fully manifest in those. It's sort of they're somehow lesser, as his qualities are not fully revealed in there. And this is important for Jiva Goswami because it means that if you start from the bottom, the qualities are something extraneous, something that can be added to it. If you start from the top, it means God's qualities are intrinsic to him, and this is how you have to start. And then when you come to Brahman, it basically means, Jiva Goswami says, it's that form of God where just you're not aware of any of his attributes. His attributes are there, but you're just not aware of them. They're just and he uses the technical term. He says that. God's qualities are samavaya. Samavaya is sort of inherent in him. They're sort of intrinsic to him. They're not samyoga. They're not linked to him in any way. So when you think of God's attributes, they're intrinsic to him. They're non-different from him. They are him. You cannot sort of say that, okay, here we add some qualities to God, or these are added to him. This is not the case. So the only thing as you go down in the hierarchy is just lesser and lesser qualities. Now, the way he explains this is through this here, the Antaranga Shakti, the internal energy, which is the Swarupa Shakti, the energy of his own nature. And this he would characterize again, you again have three and you have the Santini, the Samvit, and the Hladini Shakti. There's three types of potency. The Santini is that the potency of existing, the capacity to exist, basically, but also to give existence to others. Then you have the Samvit, that's the potency to be aware, to perceive, and but also to give perception and awareness to others. And then you have Hladini, that's the potency, the energy to enjoy and to give enjoyment to him. And of course, as you might know, as you might sort of hear in this, you get the very basic thing, Satchit Ananda, in this. Santini, the potency to exist, that is Sat. The potency to be aware, that is Chit, and the potency to enjoy, that is Ananda. And in Vedanta, Satchit Ananda is, of course, a very important thing, and these characteristics are said to be intrinsic to God. So Jiva Goswami says, yes, and these are the Shaktis that are associated with these things, but they're intrinsic to God. Now, of course, he says, since with the Antaranga Shakti, we're in God's own sort of essence, really. So he introduces here sort of three categories. So is he not introducing diversity within God? Is this not sort of minimizing God's unity? And he would say, no, this is just different ways of looking at it. Satchit Ananda is actually one, but sometimes Ananda will manifest, so sometimes bliss will be more prominent. Then you can say, okay, this is Ananda. And sometimes knowledge will be more manifest, and you say, okay, this is Chit, and sometimes just pure existence in there, and that is Sat. So there are just different ways of manifesting, but they're really intrinsic and non-different from God. Now, let's see. Okay. I gave you a lengthy description there, which is Jiva Goswami's definition of Bhagavan. The way this works is that you have those three Shaktis, Bahiranga, Antaranga, and Tathasta Shakti, and you have God's energies, which Jiva Goswami repeatedly says they're actually innumerable. He can, you know, he has innumerable potencies or energies. He would say that Bhagavan is the one who has most of these, who has all of these energies. In Paramatma, this is limited, and there only the energies in that are that relate to this world, to creation, are manifest. So this is sort of the emphasis on this side here. And then in Brahman, there's no energies at all. There's just sort of they're totally stripped of that. You're not aware of that. And it's interesting, Jiva Goswami is he sort of looks at this in two ways, these three levels of God. On the one hand, he sees them as sort of ontologically distinct aspects of God's nature, but on the other hand, there's also a sense of the awareness of it. So it's, you know, the person, a person in this world who practices, you know, who does this religious practice, and so on, may realize a particular manifestation of God, and that's sort of his own perception of God. But there's sort of that other aspect as well, that God's nature is like that. So he plays with, he sort of switches between those two ways of analyzing this. So Bhagavan is he who is full in all Shaktis, in all potencies. And you have this very lengthy description there, which is from the Bhagavad Sandarbha. And it summarizes Jiva Goswami's understanding of God very, very well. So he says, he who is the very form of existence, consciousness, and bliss, that is Satchit Ananda. So he who is the very form of that, he's non-different from those qualities, who possesses inconceivable, multifarious, and unlimited energies or Shakti that are of his own nature. They're his Swarupa Shakti, and they're non-different from him, just like the heat is non-different from the fire, who's the ocean of unlimited, mutually contradictory qualities, such that in him both the attribute and the possessor of attributes, the lack of differences and the varieties of differences, formlessness and form, pervasiveness and centrality. I'm not sure what the centrality He uses madhyamatva, sort of the being in the middle. All are true. So he's able to reconcile all these different things. And of course, ultimately it's achintya, Jiva Goswami would say. But of course you can see that he's Brahman. He's formless, but yet he has a form in Bhagavan. He's attributeless in Brahman, yet he has attributes in Bhagavan. So he sort of is able to reconcile all these things. Whose beautiful form is distinct from both gross and subtle entities, self-luminous and consisting entirely of his own nature, who has unlimited such forms that are manifest by his chief form called Bhagavan, whose left side is beautified by Lakshmi, the manifestation of his personal energy suitable to his own form, who resides in his own abode along with his attendants, who are furnished with a form that is a special manifestation of his own splendor. All these things, this is very crucial for Jiva Goswami, that God's own form, God's own qualities, God's own attributes, but also God's own abodes and God's sort of attendants in that abode, the liberated beings, they are all part of this. They're all part of the Antaranga Shakti. They're non-different from him. And this is some, I mean, if you read the Sandarbhas, this comes up again and again, and you might kind of wonder, well, why, you know, I got the point now, you know, why is he always stressing on this? Why is this such a big deal for him? But the reason this is a big deal for him, because if he wants to establish this very firmly, that God's form, God's abode, God's attendance, God's qualities, God's activities, they're all intrinsic to God. You cannot see them separate from God. If you do see them separate from God, you do not understand God. You're like the followers of Shankara, who sort of see an attributeless absolute as the highest, and then these activities, the abodes, the qualities, the form, and so on, all as extraneous. You're not actually understanding God, Jiva Goswami. You're not actually understanding Bhagavan. Bhagavan has these things intrinsic to him. He goes on, who astonishes the host of Atmaramas. The Atmaramas are those that take pleasure in the self, basically the liberated beings, by his wonderful qualities, pastimes, etc., which are characterized by the play of his personal energy. So again, the emphasis that his activities are part of his own personal energy, and they're part of his Antaranga Shakti. And the Atmaramas, this is a very important thing for Jiva Goswami, in that he sort of pops up in different places. They're those that are liberated from matter. They have attained liberation, and yet they become attracted by the qualities of God. So for Jiva Goswami, this is proof that God's qualities are not material, are not part of this here, of the Bahiranga Shakti, of this material manifestation, but they're actually non-material. They're fully spiritual. They're fully part of his being, and whose own generic brilliance is manifested in the form of reality of Brahman. That's Shankaracharya's Brahman, and that's the attributeless. So he's the sort of resting place of that. He's the foundation of that. And that the Brahman fully depends on him, not the other way around. Who is the sole shelter and life of his marginal energy, called the living beings, the Jiva, whose mere reflected energy are the modes of nature visible in the unlimited phenomenal world. He is Bhagavan. So you again have the reflected energy, that's the reflection of the sun, that's the Bahiranga Shakti, the external energy. And the jivas, they're the tathastha shakti, they're the sort of the marginal energy, the ones that are on the border. And he's there, what does he say? Who's the sole shelter and life of his marginal energy. So he's their support and so on. And there's one final point I want to make. And that's something that comes up only later in Jiva Goswami's writings. You read through the Sandarbhas, and you start with the Tattva Sandarbha, which is about epistemology and so on. You go on to the Bhagavats and the Paramatma Sandarbha, which is about sort of the nature of God in sort of a very in sort of a very abstract sense, in a way. But then later in his works, you get to the path of devotion and so on. And there, and in his commentaries on Rupa Goswami's works, there's sort of other ideas that come up, and that is that within the Bhagavan, within the form of God, the highest manifestation of God, there's still a division there, and there's sort of different different ways in which God reveals his himself, and you have two terms there. You have the Aishvarya, which is sort of the majesty of God, and you have the Madhurya, which is the sweetness of God. If you can say the Aishvarya, the majesty of God, that is God's godness, that's sort of his nature of being God, that's of being the controller of everything, of being the creator of everything, of being the maintainer of everything, of being someone who's, you know, infinitely powerful and so on. It's sort of God as is generally conceived of as being God. Whereas the Madhurya, that's you could say his humanness. It's God's sweetness, it's his charm, it's his attractiveness and so on. And in the first lecture of this series, Jessica was saying that you were talking about devotion and so on. And you said that can you love God if God is the same as you? And you know, you were using it in a very sort of theological sense or philosophical sense, if he's of the same nature as you, and so on. I would say Jiva Goswami says you cannot love God unless he's the same as you, in the sense that only when God is manifest in a sort of shows his humanness, his sweetness, his charmingness, then you can fully love him. If the Aishvarya aspect predominates, the sort of the majesty of God predominates, it doesn't inspire any love in you. It inspires fear and so on. And you see this, of course, in the Gita, in that, you know, in the 11th chapter, when God reveals his majestic form, then Arjuna is afraid. And Jiva Goswami says, yeah, this is what happens. When God reveals his sweetness, this is the highest aspect. When God reveals his majesty, this is a lower aspect, because it inhibits love. You cannot love God fully if he's this majestic deity that's all-powerful. Jiva Goswami says you cannot have one without the other. I mean, they're two aspects of God's nature, and they're sort of intrinsic to him, of course. But sometimes one predominates and sometimes the other. But he says they're always there. Even when God manifests his sweetness, his humanness, the majesty is always there. And this is important, because if you just have the sweetness without the majesty, then it's just sort of an ordinary human. And why would you love an ordinary human in such an extraordinary way? You know, why would you, as Jiva Goswami, to devote your whole life to that, and not to just some other being that's in the same room as you, for example. So we'd say, no, when God manifests the sweetness, the majesty is there, but it's sort of hidden. And he gives the analogy of the Saraswati, which is a river that's sort of non-existent, according to Hindu tradition, you cannot perceive it, but it's sort of set to flow in sort of hidden, but it meets the Ganga, and so he says this is how God's majesty is. When God's sweetness is there, the majesty is there, but it's hidden like the Saraswati, and it sort of flows along the Ganges. The Ganges is the sweetness, of course, and then the majesty is sort of hidden, but the majesty gives significance to the sweetness. You have a verse there from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is Rupa Goswami's work, which is Jiva Goswami's uncle's writing. But Jiva Goswami quotes this verse in several places. So he says, even though from a philosophical perspective there's no difference in the essential nature of the Lord of Sri and Krishna, the disposition of rasa is such that it reveals the form of Krishna to be the most excellent. So he would say that those forms of God, that those aspects of God that stresses his majesty, they're non-different from those aspects of God that manifest his sweetness. From a philosophical point of view, you cannot say, okay, this one is better than this one, or this one is sort of more natural to God than this one. They're totally identical. But he says, from an emotional point of view, if you want, from the point of view of love, the one that characterizes the sweetness, the madhurya, the humanness, and this in here, Krishna, is more natural, is higher, not more natural, but is higher, because it allows for a fuller range of emotions to be experienced in relation to God. Whereas when Aishwarya, majesty predominates, you cannot have some sort of such a wide range of emotions. So I'll stop here. I'll just summarize Jiva Goswami's ideas as I've presented them here for your convenience. So he starts with the essential aspect is Shakti, is the energy of God. You have the energy of God, which is like the heat of the fire, is fully dependent on God, but it's intrinsic to God. Whenever you have fire, you have heat. You cannot separate the two, and therefore they're non-different. They're God's own nature. His energy is his own nature. And yet, as I mentioned, they're also different, because you can talk about the energies of God in sort of as being separate. So that's why they're bheda bheda. They're simultaneously different and non-different from God. The energies are of three kinds, according to him. So you have the external energy, which creates, which is this material creation, which is a manifestation of God's energy, which does not reflect back on him. It's like the reflection of the sun in a body of water. And then you have the antaranga shakti, the internal energy, which is that which manifests God's own qualities and his abode and his attendants and so on. And you have the tatastha shakti, which is the living entities, which can be controlled by either of the other two energies. By arguing along these lines, Jiva Goswami is able to maintain the unity of God by saying that God is really everything there exists. God is advitiya, in the words of the Upanishad. He's one without a second. There's no other thing that exists. And yet at the same time, he's able to sort of remove the imperfections of the world from the nature of God and say they do not reflect back on God. God himself has then three features. You have Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the highest. He's the one in which the shaktis, the energies, are fully manifest. And then Paramatma is those where the energies are manifest to a lesser degree, only in relation to the creation. And then Brahman, which is where no shaktis are manifested, it's just pure attributeless aspect of God. And then within the aspect of Bhagavan, of course, he would make another distinction between God's majesty and God's humanness, sort of God's sweetness. And that the sweetness is considered higher for him when God manifests that side, because it allows for a wider range of emotions than the other aspect. So that's Jiva Goswami in a nutshell.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. It's excellent. Thank you for a very detailed, information-rich and very suggestive explanation of all the different aspects of what's going on in Jiva Goswami. Very complex, but very coherent in many ways. I have a question, but if someone else would like to go first, I would welcome that so I can think more deeply about my question. We're just a little rough hewn at the moment, so. Anyone?
I'll just give
go
you
ahead.
Time to think. What interests me is how you can make a decision between different theorists, say Shankara, Ramanuja, and Jivaraswamy. How do you make that decision? I mean, do you think Goswami is saying this is the truth and the rest of it wrong? I mean, he sometimes probably speaks like that, but on the other hand, it's very difficult to grasp the truth in these areas, isn't it? And it strikes me, and I found what you said very clear, very illuminating, but it struck me that it was a matter of taste, largely, how you decided to say that Brahman was greater or less than. So what's your view about that?
Of course, like Jiva Goswami and Ramanuja and Madhva and so and Shankara and so on, they would say, I mean, for them, the issue is what do the sacred texts say? That's for them the crucial issue, and therefore, if you read, you know, any of these authors, for them they'll often say, you know, they'll have their argument, and then to sort of corroborate their points, they'll say, you know, Shvetashvatara Upanishad says such and such thing, and sometimes that's the end of an argument, that you know, they say something and then they just throw a text in that corroborates their statement, and that's for them the end, and that shows that they're right and the others are wrong. So that's one aspect of this whole Vedanta, basically, of these different authors arguing with each other. It is true that I mean, the I guess it's a sort of a much wider thing that that applies not just to Vedanta, but, you know, what is true and what is not true, and how do you know? But what I wanted to show is that that if you approach Jiva Goswami, for example, you have to understand him as sort of, you have to follow his train of thought. So he starts from Bhagavan, for example, and he sort of goes down, where Shankara would go up. And because Shankara goes up, he would of course say, well, therefore this is Brahman is really sort of the ultimate. If God has no qualities, that's really the highest form of God. Whereas for Jiva, it's the other way around, because he reasons in a very different way. He thinks in a very different way. So if you would say to Jiva Goswami, well, the highest form of God has no qualities, he will look at you and say, well, that's very weird, you know, why'd you say this? You know, it's just the opposite. The highest form of God is unlimitedly qualified in you know, unlimited ways. But yeah, how do you say, well, this one is better than this one? It is a matter of taste, I would say.
Or it could be a matter of the sort of devotion that springs from the scheme you've got.
Mm.
I mean, presumably, Krishna would rank much more highly for Goswami
than
Shankara, where he wouldn't rank very highly at all.
Mm.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was thinking along these words. Just thinking about, actually, I was thinking about the Buddha recently, and just thinking about how he dealt with the question you asked, sort of sidestepped and said, well, you can't know about God really, in terms of, yeah, know fully what it is and or what the nature of the self is. So in response to all these sort of speculations about the nature of God and reality, he said he had a realization that life is suffering and it's caused by craving and, you know, whatever he did. So he focused on the practice and just said, well, you know, you do the practice and then it will awaken unto you whatever the realization is. And I was thinking about that, and in comparison to this very complex and tricky theology, philosophy, and my question was, in what sense is, you know, you call it a chintya, it's inconceivable. So he was performing exegesis, like he was basing this on the Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Purana. So in one sense, was he explaining or teasing out sort of the nature of God from this, or did he also claim to have an experience of this, that this is actually tattva, this is, you know, in what that, like the Buddha, that he wasn't following, he had an experience, and what he spoke of was his realization. What's Sri Goswami doing here?
As far as I know, I'm not aware of any passage where Jiva Goswami himself would say that, you know, I have had such and such, you know, realization, or I have such and such experience, and whatever I'm going to write flows from that. I'm not aware that of any passage where he would say that. He has a very, very, I mean, the most of the Tattva Sandarbha is entirely devoted to the Bhagavata and as a text. And it's the authority of the Bhagavata for him comes from the experience of the author of the Bhagavata, Vyasa. And in the Bhagavata, in the beginning of the Bhagavata, said that Vyasa, you know, he goes into meditation and then is deeply absorbed in meditation and has a vision of God and of Maya. And for Jiva Goswami, that experience, he attaches a lot of importance to that and says the authority of the Bhagavata comes from that experience. Because Vyasa had that vision of God and Maya and so on, the entire Bhagavata, the entire book he wrote after that, flows from that experience. So that is there. But I was going to say something else. But yeah, oh yeah, the Achintya part. Jiva Goswami doesn't use the Achintya as kind of a cop out and say that to sort of say, well, it's achintya, it's inconceivable, therefore we don't even have to try and conceive of it. And that's not the way he works. I mean, Jiva Goswami is very intellectual and very sharp in his reasoning and so on. And he attaches a lot of importance to that. But it's sort of an acknowledgement that he makes that your reason will only take you so far. And beyond that, it's achintya. Beyond that, it's inconceivable. We cannot comprehend it. And is of course a theme that comes up in the Bhagavata throughout, in the Upanishads, that words and the mind cannot reach God, because they're basically here, they're in the Bahiranga Shakti, they're in the external energy. So this cannot comprehend God's Antaranga Shakti, his own the sort of the aspects of his own nature, and our minds are made of matter in the Indian sense. And our senses are made of matter, and so on. So therefore, they're in so there's just an acknowledgement that it takes us so far, and then it's enough. And this is something we see in Vedanta, in all Vedantic traditions, really, that there's an awareness that reasoning is not the way you can understand God, basically. And Ramanuja, for example, he argues against it in the very beginning of the Brahma Sutra, where he says that a thing like the sort of cosmological argument for the existence of God, that, you know, you have the world, which is an object, and every object has a maker, like a pot, you know, the traditional Vedantic analogy, that you have a pot, and that's made by you know, the potter. So therefore, you know, the pot is an object and it has a creator. The world is an object, therefore it must have a creator. Ramanuja actually rejects that argument and says this is a bad. This cannot lead you to understanding God, because it doesn't say anything about God. Maybe there were two potters who made the pot. Maybe the potter is dead. You know, so how do we? It doesn't. It gives us an indication, but it's not conclusive in our understanding of God. And Jiva Goswami would share that, and they would say, well, the only way you can know about God is through the sacred text, through revelation, basically. And that's why their whole thing is about revelation.
Can I jump with a quick question? I know probably perhaps a lot of people need to move on, but just briefly, I'm going to be, I get all frustrated with this, because in some ways one sees thinkers like, I'll call him thinker rather than a theologian for a specific reason, thinkers like Jiva Goswami and others in this period as very unphilosophical in the long run, as basically just theologians who just take their text and their bit of love for God, and that devotional and textual authority is really what drives them in the end. So they do all this reasoning, but in the end it falls apart because they're just religious blokes. And I'm very very uncomfortable with that, partly because I think they themselves, I don't think they just give up their methodology at the last gasp, and also because things like Neo-Nyaya, there were many ways in which the structures of careful philosophical reasoning were sort of important then, debate and all these different things. But I just wonder then with Jiva whether it seems right to you that there is still a fairly solid attempt to make it all make good sense for him. And for instance, in areas like, it seems to me there's an issue with his desire for us to be separate from God, i.e. like the reflection, not touching the sun. And yet at the same time he says that we are from the Tatastha Shakti, and the Shaktis are actually still really intrinsically part of God. So is he making a jump here to try and keep us separate, but ignoring the fact that really the Shaktis come from God? Or is he in the end making an acknowledgement with this new Shakti-oriented concept of Godhead that the ultimate God really is plural? I mean, maybe Advaitic, but plurally Advaitic. You know, is he compromising Advaita and really fundamentally saying this is a plural Godhead?
Okay, I'll get back to that second one because I'm not sure I got it. Mm-hmm. But the first aspect about Jiva Goswami as a thinker and so on, I think what you didn't explain it very well earlier on, but I think you the way you have to look at Jiva Goswami is not as a philosopher who kind of uses scripture as kind of a cop out, or in the sense that okay, this is ultimately this text says X, Y, Z, therefore that's the case and the end of the discussion, but rather the other way around, that this is where he starts from, and then he builds up from that. So his whole the entire Sandarbhas, what he's trying to do, the Sandarbhas are sometimes called the Bhagavata Sandarbha, the text that weaves the Bhagavata together. And what he's trying to do is basically give a sort of a comprehensive theology of the Bhagavata, of this sacred text. And the Tattva Sandarbha, in the very beginning of this lengthy work, he establishes, he tries to establish the authority of the text and of revelation and so on over inference, over reasoning, over sensory perception and so on. So that's his starting point. So rather than look at him as a philosopher who tries to who sort of is not a very good philosopher in the sense that he just kind of goes to sacred authority and says okay, that's the end of the discussion here because I've quoted a text and since this text is authoritative you can't question this and therefore I win. Rather than look at him like that, I think you can look at him as somebody who's trying to make sense of this text and trying to show the theology of this text in the way that he understands it. So it's a different approach that he takes. Does that make...
Yeah, basically. I mean, in the end, you still wonder why he chooses the plural God, or why he chooses ultimately devotion, or why what his... why he falls back on them, but okay, thank you. That answers that part. And the last thing is the reflection is separate from the sun, but the Shakti is part of God. Is there a problem? Is there a contradiction?
No. Okay. The analogy with the sun is actually an analogy he uses. He draws a lot from that as well, and I just used one aspect of it. But he will say, you have the sun, and the you have the god of the sun, the sun god, and he says that's like Bhagavan, that's an aspect of the sun that's fully qualified, that has attributes and so on, and then you have the then you have the sort of the the fire or the luminosity of the sun that's sort of within the sun globe itself. He would say that's the Antaranga Shakti, that's the internal energy of God. And then you have the sun rays. He says those are the Tathasta Shakti, those are the living entities. And they are God, but they're not God. And I give you a passage at the end there, we don't have time to get into it. But there he argues like that, that when you're sitting, you know, somebody that's been born in a dark room has never seen the sun, there's a little hole in the wall and the sun rays come through. You can say, well, meditate on this sun ray that comes into the room, and that's, you know, then you can come to an understanding of God. So he uses that analogy to explain when the Upanishads say, you know, tattvamasi, you are that. That means you are sort of part of the existence of God, but you're one of his shaktis. And then the Bahiranga Shakti is the reflection of the sun in the body of water. Now, the Bahiranga is really sort of a removed energy of God. It's sort of something that's it's an aspect of God's nature. But the way he says that it doesn't reflect back on God is through this bheda bheda, that it is God and yet it isn't God. So it has its separate existence in a sense, like you have in that passage. Maya is that which where Bhagavan is not. So it has sort of its separate existence, but yet it is fully dependent on God's existence. And it's sort of a one-way thing, if you want, that God influences the world, but the world does not influence God. And he sort of remains aloof from that. I don't know if that.
No, that's helped. So the power that makes the sun ray is God, but the sun ray itself isn't quite God in the same way. So okay, that's good. Thank you for clarifying.
It's like, you know, when the sun rays come into the room, I can say the sun is the, you know, or their sun. But if the sun were really to be in this room, we'd all die and we'd burn. So there's a difference. It's not that the sun is here, but when the sun rays comes in, I can say, oh, the sun is here. So that's the way of Jiva. So that, I mean, it has a lot of sort of hermeneutical aspects to it as well. Mm-hmm. So therefore, when you know, the Bhagavata or the Upanishads or something talk about the sun, sometimes he can sort of pass the reference and say, okay, here this doesn't refer to God but to the self or something like that, or the other way around. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it gives a lot of leeway. Okay, so we're not part of God. I'm disappointed. Anyway,
I mean, we are and we aren't. That's his answer. Of course, he, like in his commentary on the Bhaktarasamrita Sindhu, who says that somebody who practices the path of devotion, he should not think too much about the oneness. So the abheda part should be somewhat neglected. Because otherwise, why would you love God? You know, if you're God, you know, if the sun ray is the sun, then why would the sun ray love the sun? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a mixed.
I'm going
to
be thinking about why sun rays love the sun for a while now. Okay, thank you very much for the. I guess I'll, unless anyone has anything urgently they want to, we can carry on afterwards. But for those who do need to move on, thank you very, very much. Very informative. Very detailed, very clear, very coherent understanding, and with plenty of achintya in the gaps in between. Mm-hmm. That's good. Thank you very much, Rambit.
Thank you.
You deserve a much bigger audience.
Can I just ask another question? You know, just back to Jessica's question about, you know, philosophers and their approach within Vedanta, is this performing exegesis, basically, it's within the realm of scriptural interpretation. It never really gets from that, and they push the sort of reason, and you know, and to a certain level, then it's a cutoff point, and it's like, well, you know, so far shall you go, but not any further. So scripture is the bottom line. But you know, Shankara says that, you know, even though that takes you there, you still have to have your aha, your awakening yourself. Is it the same with Jiva Goswami, that even though, yes, you take scripture as, you know, guiding you, you know, beyond the realms of rationality and philosophical discourse, do you still have to have an aha or a devotional, you know, realization of what the scripture is saying to have true knowledge, or is it just accept what it says in the scriptures, or do you have to have, like in the Vedanta thing, your own aha or experience?
For what?
For knowledge, for a true, like, to
okay.
Yeah. to know God, knowledge of God.
Yeah.
Goswami says that. I'm just thinking that it's...
I mean, in the sense that he would say that, that scripture teaches... I mean, you have the notion that pops up in like the Gita and in the Bhagavata and so on, that where it says that you can know God through devotion. Krishna says that in the Gita and in the Bhagavata, you have in several places, is that you can know God through devotion. So there, the devotion becomes sort of a way of acquiring knowledge, basically. We generally think of devotion as sort of just an emotion that, I love such and such person or something like that. But the understanding is that by loving God, there's sort of a revelation of God's nature, and one acquires knowledge of God's being. So that's there. But he wouldn't, I mean, Shankara would say that scripture is inherently sort of defective in a way, because it describes, because it describes Brahman, and Brahman cannot be described, therefore, scripture must be ultimately inferior and sort of defective. Jiva Goswami would not argue that. He would say that scripture describes God, but God cannot be described in the sense that God cannot be fully described. So I can describe God, but it's just a tiny aspect of God. And there's some understanding there, but I cannot comprehend God and sort of capture God in my words or in my thoughts or something like that. But it doesn't mean that I cannot talk about God in any meaningful way, like Shankaracharya would say. So that's a big difference for them. And why Shankara would argue the way you said.
But Shankara is supposed to have written hymns to
Shiva.
Quite devotional.
And Narayan.
Yeah.
Very devotional.
Got that.
Contradiction, that man.
Yeah.
something for everyone.
He's got hierarchies. It's perfect. He's got the higher, the lower, the still lower, and even higher, and all these different paths. It's impossible when you're teaching the Hindu studies classes to get an answer about what is the truth about the Gita, about this theologian. And they go, well, there's many. There's some better ones and some less ones. And kind of what you're saying, what your disposition is will lead you to.
What's interesting is somebody like me, since I don't accept the scriptures as inerrant, what does this mean?
Yeah.
What can I do if they're not, my interest is not in what would the scriptures say.
Yeah. but
what comes out of it. It's interesting, and lots of interesting things do come out of it, but you're deprived of the resolution of saying, well, that's how I interpret scripture, because I don't care.
So I think it's not, this is where I get frustrated. All these people with their scriptures, all these places where they seem to go, it's not very non-dual, but don't worry about it too much, because the Bhagavata says love is the main thing, and duality helps you with the love, so don't really worry about that too much. I think that's not quite how it works out, and I think, for instance, when you think about the different sects going and having these debates, using the rules of Neo and Navya-Nyaya logic as their premise, and they win and they lose, not only on the basis of scripture, but on the basis of how well they've reasoned according to very formal rules of logical debate, I think they do end up having to make it all make sense, and that actually, if one goes far enough, there are ways in which they see their solutions as not only scripturally appealing and devotionally appealing, but making most sense.
Yeah, but that's what I wanted to convey when I said that Jiva Goswami's first he starts with scripture rather than end with it.
Yeah.
So he starts with that, but then within sort of the way of looking at scripture, there are rules, and you see that in Vedanta, in the various schools. That they criticize their opponent not just for sort of misreading text or what they perceive as to be misreading, but also for using bad logic or something like that. And you could say, well, why does this matter? Since scripture is the ultimate, but it's not that they fully reject that, but it's sort of to be supported by.
After all, the scripture describes reality, and reality has to make sense. So I think the scripture is seen to be intrinsically logical. It's just you have to find out the ways in which it is.
Could it be also, if we look at the cultural context, that in India, everyone, even PhDs in India, refer to the last PhD as nearly a sampradaya. You can just change a few words, but it's the you have to acknowledge the person who went before. So even in the Gaudiya tradition, Jiva Goswami will acknowledge Sridhar, who wrote the first commentary on the Bhagavad, the first Vaishnava commentary on the Bhagavad Puran. There wasn't a Vaishnava commentary really, so he acknowledges him and defends him judiciously, as Chaitanya did. But he's theologically a million miles away. No one follows him, but everyone nods their head. So in the same way, is there not an element that he's using the same scriptures that Sankara is using and coming to completely different conclusions? So he's saying the scriptures are infallible, but his interpretation of scripture is completely different. He has gone on a philosophical journey. That, like you say, he starts with scripture, but as to whether he's saying how much scriptures are infallible, I think we have to understand the cultural hermeneutic that everyone looks at the scripture, salutes, pays obeisances, does pujas and walks around five times and then goes off to do whatever he likes. There is an element of that about it, because you know, Shankaracharya is using the same scripture, Ramanuja.
Yeah,
and the scriptures have ambiguities in them. I mean,
they all know the text very well. But I mean, the way I look at it, the difference in their approaches is that they'll use the same texts, but Shankara will say, this passage here, this is the way to understand the entire text. And if you understand this passage, then everything else in this text has to be understood through the light of this passage. And then, you know, Ramanuja comes along and says, no, it's not this passage, but it's this passage. And sort of this passage becomes the passage that harmonizes all the various opinions and sort of the different views in the text. And that's the way they work. And in that sense, what I, you know, sometimes I get the impression that these different schools, in some ways, they're talking not to each other, but sort of alongside each other. Because, I mean, what they'd have to do is argue against Shankara why, and sometimes they do, Jiva Goswami and so on do this, why, you know, such and such passage cannot be taken as the sort of the key passage in the text, and why this passage needs to be. But it's sort of a very complex debate, and because, you know, I can say to, or Jiva Goswami says to, you know, say he meets Shankara and he says, no, scripture teaches this, and Shankara will say, no, scripture teaches that. The reason they say it, because they start from a different point in the same text.
But there's also all these bits where, I mean, of course they all have different schools to draw on. Some are using Sankhya, some are using Vedanta, some are using Mimamsa, so there are different ways to do it. There are also bits where, in addition to disagreeing with Shankara on those things, they say, Shankara doesn't make sense, because he's ended up as a dualist after pretending to be an Advaitin. He says there's, you know, Brahman, and then there's Maya, which isn't really there. It's kind of a separate reality. And he has all these weird bits where he tries to talk about how Brahman can generate Maya, and it doesn't really make very much sense. Or if it does, it's very obscure. So they're also really, I think, rationally, and that's not separate from the theology, it's with the theology, rationally saying, Shankara, you don't make sense. And so we have to get a new understanding of plurality in God. If we don't do that, we're lost.
But they would say that if Shankara has crummy arguments, this is proof that he's not reading the text correctly. In the sense that if he were to read the text correctly, his arguments would make sense. But because he has this passage and this passage, and he has to make sense of them, and therefore he comes up with this idea, you know, a particular idea. And if that idea doesn't make sense, they will say, well, this is proof that, you know, he didn't read the text correctly.
There's another element too, which is, I mean, you mentioned how the same text can be read in very different ways, but also very different texts like the Bible and the Srivastava or whatever can be read in the same way. So there's a peculiarity that you can get people from very, and I can look at this and say, hey, that's just like Tertullian or somebody in the Christian tradition, and I could get the same problem. So are they interpreting scripture? Well, the answer is probably not. They don't even pretend to try sometimes. No, they obviously say it didn't contradict.
What I like about it is it seems to me there's a certain continuum of working out ways in which matter and spirit work out together.
Exactly.
It's like you've got the Buddha over here, and he's saying, you know, everyone's getting their proverbials in a twist over it. Let's just focus on the practice and whatever, you know, we will attain something, nirvana.
Mm.
And then Shankar kind of hijacks it a bit and just says the same thing, very close to, but just puts a name on it, Brahman. There is a something, but you can't know it. And then it just progressively goes on about the matter and the spirit, and yes, there is a something, and you can know it. It's personal and impressed, so it's nuanced of the same thing.
Mm.
And even, you know, this is just Vedanta. Then you move over to the whole Shaiva, and you find the same thing going on there. You know, the Shaiva Siddhanta, and it's like, what's their big issue? Well, what is the nature of Shiva? Are you one with it, or are you in somehow qualifiedly different, distinct from it? And right across the board, it seems to be everyone's debating what's the nature of the something that is something. And, you know, there's definitely a something, and how you call it, but...
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Well, you're there, and I'm here, unless... Yeah, mind you, there's so to say, unless the Charvaka said it's all there.
Yeah. There's a nice bit in the beginning of Gavin's intro to Hinduism where he, you know, everyone's very cautious about saying anything general about anything, obviously.
Yeah.
But he does say, in his Gavinish way, unity and plurality.
Yeah.
It's a pervasive...
Absolutely.
And then he stands back from that. You know, but it is kind of true. Every single school, the Jains are talking about
anekanta,
you know, many pointed truth, and you know, and that's right. What's interesting is Ramanuja has his methods, and with the Shaktis, you get a completely different paradigm of process and activity and agency, which gives you a new way to do it. And then Shankara's got consciousness and conceptual division, and actually see the same debates in Aristotle and Plato and Heraclitus, and you know, though I don't want to sound like a perennialist, but there are key questions.
It may be that when we examine it from a Western philosophical perspective, India never made that distinction between philosophy and theology.
Oh, well, definitely not.
Just
but neither did the West for a long time.
For a long time. But our friend Kant.
16th century, probably.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit earlier than that.
Yeah.
Descartes.
Yeah.
Probably people like that. Yeah.
And of course, Descartes in the end always brings in God.
Hmm.
How do I know this?
Yes,
book?
But as Pascal said, the God of the philosophers,
oh,
not
was a different
the God of Abraham.
I don't know, I like Descartes' thing. God wouldn't let me perceive that elephant as a book, because he loves me. You know, there's something very sweet and benevolent in his philosopher's God in a funny kind of way. Of course he's nice, even to him.
I'm the only defender of Descartes left in the Western world.
Aww. Aww. He's got such a good history.